Today is Monday, May 24th, 2010. This is Kevin Collins, and today's interview is with Romano Mazzoli, former congressman for 12 terms from 1970 to 1994 for the 3rd Congressional District of Kentucky. Good morning, Congressman.
Good morning, Kevin. Good to be with you again.
Good to see you.
In our third session. Very nice.
Yes, indeed. I thought today we might talk about folks that you knew in your 24 years in Congress, beginning with people that you hired for your various staffs in Washington, D.C., or in your district office here in Louisville, and then move on to your reminiscences about presidents, vice presidents, congressmen, senators, international figures you may have met in your work.
It's a wonderfully interesting topic. I'll have to bridle myself today because I could go on for hours and hours for each of these people. Was very important to me in some fashion or form, and to Helen as well, because once again, all these people that I'll mention today, save the members of Congress, what have you, but certainly all the staff people were close friends of Helen's and mine, and as well as co-workers. But to start out with, and I think it'd be interesting to begin with the administrative assistants, and just for the listener, the term in Congress is used as administrative assistant, but we would perhaps use the term as office manager, staff director, he or she, because we had both male and female administrative assistants, he or she actually runs the office. Now, I do ultimately have the say, and I make the final decision, but that person is there day-to-day, every day, even when I was out of town, and they're the ones that make sure the workflow is caught up, the mail gets processed, that the calls get returned, and so they're really hands-on managers of the office. The first one of those is Bob Baughman, B-A-U-G-H-M-A-N. Currently, Bob lives in Arizona in Oro Valley, which is fairly near Tucson. But Bob was a Louisvillian, an Eagle Scout, a very active member of the Scout movement, and when I was elected to the state Senate in 1968 and took part in the 68 session and the 1970 session, Bob was with the Legislative Research Commission, which is that arm of state government which helps members frame the issues, helps members with research, helps members to draft bills that may want to accomplish such ends as they wish to accomplish legislatively. And Bob impressed me as he worked with the what we call the LRC, Legislative Research Commission, and I found him to be a very a man of depth, a trained lawyer, so he understood all the legal jargon, I guess we'd call it, the legal terminology. And he understood the legislative process at Frankfort, which isn't all that much different than Washington. There are a lot of transferable parts. I mean, you introduce a bill in one house, and it's introduced maybe in the other house, and one house passes it, the other house passes it. That doesn't make it law. They got to go through a reconciliation procedure, and even that doesn't make it law. It has to be approved by both bodies again, and then it has to be sent to the governor who, as we have it in Washington, the right of veto, and the vetoes can be sustained or they can be overridden. So anyway, Bob had an intimate knowledge of the whole process. So when it came to pass that I was elected to Congress, one of the first people that I contacted was Bob Baughman about his maybe coming to Washington. Well, he was pretty well ensconced at Frankfort, but I think Bob had a real interest in what was going on. He followed the campaign. I don't remember his being active in it, but he couldn't because he was part of state government. But in any event, he obviously observed it and perhaps felt that I had something to commend me based on his observation of my work in the state Senate, where I did receive commendations from the press and from my peers there. So Bob then accompanied me as my very first staff assistant, my very first staff director, my first administrative assistant to Washington. It was he who primarily, with one exception, hired the staff. And I may have mentioned in an early tape, and I'll talk about her in a moment, Olive Dodario, who became my personal assistant. To say she was secretary is to diminish her role, to say that she was my close friend and confidant and protector and advisor is to be a little more accurate. But save Olive's hiring, which came through Peter Rodino, the member of Congress, everybody else Bob hired, and I can't remember each one in our first staff, but it was a very small staff. We had maybe three or four people. And then, and I'll mention him in just a moment, who's passed away, unfortunately, Cecil Noel by reason of his activity on my congressional campaign, along with Charlie Mattingly, but it was Cecil who became my staff director, administrative assistant in the Louisville office to start out with. So it was primarily Cecil who had the responsibilities that Bob had in D.C. to run the place and for the both of them to coordinate, because I've said in an earlier tape that I always felt the Louisville office was the premier office. It was that office that people came to. It was the visible office in the federal building, which, as I mentioned before, is one unexpected but a happy fact that it now carries my name. But it was Cecil who then did that sort of thing. But Bob Bachman served me from 1971, and you reminded me of these dates. I would not have remembered them, Kevin. But Bob was with me as administrative assistant from my first day, January the 3rd of 1971, to 1976, when he left to stay in Washington to work with another member for a while, a member from Hawaii, Cecil Heftel. And then Bob stayed on in Washington for two or three different posts with various NGOs and various trade association groups that had offices in Washington. Remained a very close friend.
Let me ask you very quickly, Congressman. The administrative assistants that you had tend to stay for something between 4 and 6 years. Is that a common stretch? Do people get burned out doing this kind of work, or do they just move on in their careers? Or?
Well, each and every one of these, and I'll mention them all, moved because they had an offer that they couldn't refuse. You know, going back to The Godfather, I'll make you an offer that you can't refuse. Mm-hmm. So no one left because of burnout. They left because they either wanted to go back home, they wanted to do something differently. They had an offer. In fact, Dan Hall went back to Louisville, came back to where we are today, University right. of Louisville, to become assistant to the president, then Don Swain. So now nobody burned out. It's very common, frankly, common to have somebody stay with a member the entire career. Uh-huh. And it's more common than to have a lot of flip-flop, because these people are so key and they become so knowledgeable. They become your alter ego. They become your voice, your face, when you're not there, and even when you're there. So turnover is not always to be sought.
Is there much of an adjustment when you go from one particular assistant to another particular assistant?
Yeah, there is. I mean, you know, each one of these has a personality. I knew Bob longer since I knew him at Frankfurt, and he was a Louisvillian. It happens that only one other was from Louisville, and that was Dan Hall. They had different personalities, and you have different comfort level zones being with them. Some were more organized and clinical, and some were more personal and personable. But all of them did a fine job. I mean, I would not have stayed in office for 24 years were not these people devoted, loyal, and smart, talented, accomplished. So in each in his or her own way. But Bob was with me for those early years in his mother. And of course, I knew his mother and dad and his brother, John. And so we became close friends over those years and earlier. And in my basement today, someday you'll see it as a, I guess you'd call it like a representation of the seal of the United States, but it's done in needlepoint. And Bob's mother was very talented that way. So I have that as a memento of our years. And I see it every morning, every day, two or three times a day. And so I think of Bob. Bob, as I mentioned, after he retired, moved first to a fascinating and beautiful place in Arizona, Sedona, which is the Red Hill country, Red Rock country. And then he moved to Oro Valley, which is in near the Tucson area. After Bob came Mike Nevens, N-E-V-E-N-S. Mike was with me from 1977 to 1980. An amazing person, a remarkably brilliant man. Came to me via the University of Notre Dame. There's a huge Notre Dame club in Washington, and I was able to plug into that my very first year. And so I stayed active in Notre Dame club affairs, and I've met a lot of people, and they met me. And we go to different ball games, and so there's a lot of socializing, but a lot of networking, a lot of professional networking. And it came to pass that at one of those meetings, Mike Nevens was there. He's a 1971 graduate of Notre Dame, so much younger than me. And he indicated an interest, and one thing led to the other, and he came to my staff. An outstanding guy. I mean, he went after he left me in 1980. He went with McKinsey and Company, which is this worldwide management consultant group, which only hires the absolute cream of the crop. I mean, the very top people from the various pursuits and professions are taken by McKinsey. And Mike was not only taken by McKinsey, but became a managing partner in Palo Alto, which, as you imagine, because of Silicon Valley, was a hugely important function, which yielded for him, I'm sure, hugely important earthly comforts, and, but which he deserved entirely. A delightful man. He and his wife, Yvonne, have been our friends. We visited them in California, as we visited Bob and his partner, both in Sedona and in Oro Valley. So we stay close as much as we can when we're a continent apart. But Mike was important in many ways, Kevin, because Mike was the first one to move us into the computer era. For one thing, Bob didn't probably do it because we didn't have stuff like that. But Mike came in that era, but he also had that predisposition to be looking around for more and effective and efficient and more scientific and more computer-driven ways to do business. And that, everything from handling the mail to processing the cases to keeping the paperwork to accessing the stuff when it's done. Processing all the material that came through the desk. So he was extremely important in that way. And he also was, as you would probably imagine, he was a very organized, clinical, engineering approach. Matter of fact, if I'm not mistaken, at Notre Dame, I think he actually majored in engineering. And most of the folks who came with me are political science people or humanities. But I think Mike was one that had that background.
He wasn't a lawyer, do I remember that correctly?
Bob was a lawyer, Dan was a lawyer, but neither Sarah nor Jane are lawyers. So there was two of them were Bob and Dan Hall. Mike didn't need to be because he, like another one whom I think will actually address personally, Harris Miller, another really brilliant man who ran my immigration committee, along with Skip Endres now. But they didn't need to be lawyers because they were that smart. I mean, they knew more than the lawyers, literally. And they were just so quick to pick things up that they didn't know. So Mike didn't need to be a lawyer. He could hold off any bevy of lawyers as far as I'm concerned. But what he did was to move our office to a new era. Mike was, as you would imagine, an engineering guy, not exactly the person who was enveloping and warm and at high comfort level. I mean, he was a man who had a job to do each morning, and he wanted to do it by the end of the day. And he would tell me, he would admonish me. He was not prone to be intimidated at all. He'd tell me what I should and shouldn't do. And I would try to listen to him and try to organize my thinking and try to be more efficient and effective. The one thing he told me years ago, and I never took his advice, and I still haven't taken it, and I always, anytime I pick up a newspaper at night at home, I think, Mike, I let you down. I betrayed you. Because Mike said, never take a newspaper at home at night. Get your reading done, all of it, your professional reading, your personal reading done at night. When you go home at night, do other things. Read a book, read, you know. And I just continue, after all these years, to still link myself to current events and very little of the thought process that goes into why this current event is taking place, you know, the historical reference point. And that's where Mike was. He was amazing. He knew everything. All of my administrative assistants have been much smarter than I am. I mean, people say, well, how did you hire him? Why did you? Well, I said, for one thing, it was the good fortune of God that these people came into my pathway. But they were always smarter than I am, so I felt comfortable that way. Mike stayed with me until 1980 when the offer came from McKinsey, and he went west, and he stayed in the west. He's from Illinois, from Springfield, Illinois, originally. And he went out there and has been very content. They first lived south of L.A. and in a place, Marina Del Rey, or one of those places. Then they moved to Silicon Valley in, I think it's Los Gatos Hills or Los Altos Hills, one of those wonderful places. Again, Helen and I visited them out there. After Mike came Dan Hall. Dan was with me from 1981 to 1985 as administrative assistant. Dan had been with me as a staff Assistant Legislative Director of the House Committee on the District of Columbia. And he came up when Jimmy Carter, 1976 actually, when Jimmy Carter had been elected. And we have a wonderful picture. I'm having a copy of it made as we sit here, which is May the 24th of 2010. At Murphy's, I'm having a copy made of a picture I stumbled upon of Jimmy Carter having a meeting in the cabinet room with Charlie Diggs and Ron Dellums and Don Fraser and the people who were on the House District of Columbia Committee. And he made sure that we knew that he wanted home rule for the District of Columbia because it had been, you know, disparagingly called America's last plantation, which is to say it was run by the Hill, not run by the elected mayor. He was an appointed mayor, Walter Washington. I think the first elected mayor was Marion Barry, but it was run from the Hill, run from the House D.C. Committee, and from the D.C. Actually, the Appropriations Committee in the House had a committee on the District of Columbia, which Bill Natcher chaired for many, many years before he went to Health and Human Services and eventually became chairman of the full committee. So it was under quite a few strictures, and Jimmy Carter wanted that done and over with. So Dan reflects on this all the time, and he will when you interview him. I think if you remember the luncheon we had afterwards, we talked about it. Mm-hmm. And the luncheon we had over at the University Club, where he said, here he was, a young kid, a whippersnapper, and just barely landed in Washington. All of a sudden, we go tooling down to the White House in my little old Rambler car, and there he winds up in the cabinet room sitting there with the President of the United States. Pretty heavy thought. Well, pretty heavy thought for me, for that matter. I mean, even though I'd been in Congress for a few years, it's still pretty heavy when you get to the White House. But Dan was my administrative assistant and brought a different set of talents to the office. He was a lawyer, and so he, like Bob Bachman, could very easily parse the sentence when these bills came through and knew, once again, how to get that sort of thing done. But Dan was more of a personal kind of person. He's easier to get to know if you remember that luncheon. I mean, he's a warm and genuine guy, and the staff loved him, and I loved him. I still love him, he and Sheila, and they're now three grown children. They were little babies. Tia and Danielle and Christopher were little tiny babies when we first met Dan and Sheila Hall. Dan, as you'll know, has a great background. He was a ranking Golden Glove boxer here in Louisville. He went to Dartmouth for his undergraduate, went to Harvard Law School. As an African American, that's not an easy thing to do. And I was very pleased when, after his session of a couple of years or so on the District of Columbia Committee, Dan went back home. I hired him from a law firm who had really recommended him. But after the D.C. episode, he went back home for a year or two, and then I was pleased that he could come back as my administrative assistant. And I believe Dan was the first African-American administrative assistant in the House, so you can check with him because he probably knows that. But did wonderful work for me, wonderful work. I would have kept him forever. I think Dan might have been inclined to stay forever with me, except another one of those offers that you can't refuse came through from Don Swain, then the president of the University of Louisville, asking Dan to become his assistant, as assistant vice president, to do a lot of things, outreach. I do all the work at Frankfurt that the university needs to, you know, in effect their government affairs director. And Dan did a superb job, and of course this continues to be on the staff, going through Don Swain, John Shoemaker, and now Jim Ramsey. He's been there the whole time. So that means he's done a superb job for those guys, as he did for me, and making sure that the office ran well when I was gone. And once again, I emphasize for all these people, I could leave, as I had to do often, to go back home, leave the office, to go over to the Hill for votes, without ever one backward glance that something would not be done correctly. I was always absolutely comfortable leaving that office to whether it was Bob or Mike or Dan or Sarah or Jane or any of the other people who were there. So, but Dan then went back home to work with the University of Louisville, where he happily still is. Then came Sarah Luna, and Sarah, I think, was the first And I think Jane may have done the same thing, but Sarah was the first one who came in basically to open the mail, just a young woman, fresh out of college, basically got the job because she was probably walking the hallways like so many young people do. She was from Tennessee, so she was not a Kentuckian, didn't come with any citations from friends of mine at home. Who knows, maybe she was hired against somebody who came from home. I don't know. I tried to be an equal opportunity hire, but I wanted to get good talent. So Sarah worked her way, Kevin, from the bottom to the very top, from the opening the mail and answering the telephones to going all the way back through the legislative side into the administrative assistant position. And she acquitted herself well each and every one of those stops. She and Philip and Bradley, their son, became very close friends of ours and remain close friends. Sarah, after she did wonderful work for us for those 3 years, and remember, you got to keep in mind that Dan was there during those immigration years, and it was Sarah who was there when it came to fulfillment, to conclusion. So they really were under a lot of pressure, as was Bob because of the Vietnam War. And Dan and Sarah went through that. Now, they were not on the immigration committee. That was Harris and Bonnie and Skip and Lynn Jacquez, whom you will see and meet when you go to Washington. But they had, because at home there were a lot of ripple effects at home, antagonisms toward me because I got into the issue, antagonisms because of the fact that Bill had certain provisions in it. But they handled that with adroitness and real skill. But Sarah was obviously looked at with much fondness and affection and respect by other Hill groups. So she left and she went eventually. I'm not sure where Phil was from, Philip was from, whether he might have been from the West, but my understanding is Sarah may have stayed in town for a while, but I think she basically went west and worked with the American Travelers Association and with one of the thoroughbred industry trade groups coming from Tennessee, where they have Tennessee Walking Horses. I think maybe that may have been part of it. But anyway, she is, and she's out there now, still in, she's now in Arizona. She was in Colorado for some years. She's now in Arizona, where Bob Bachman, I don't think she's in Tucson. I think she's in Phoenix. But once again, very talented, very, very organized person, very helpful, because that was the first woman that we had. And I think some of our young staff members, the female members of our staff, found in Jane, found in Sarah a mother figure. And that was not all she was. She was the leader. She was the person who made the decisions. But she was one like Greta Stovall, where younger staff members, men and women, but women perhaps because they felt more comfortable, could maybe talk with her. So Sarah became a revered member of our staff and very, very helpful to me. After Sarah left in 89, I guess it was, you mentioned to me then, around 89, Jane Kirby, who also came to me via the Notre Dame connection. Jane is a Notre Dame graduate of a pretty late vintage. Mike was class of 71. I can't remember Jane's class, but if she came with me in 89, she can't have been many years out of school, maybe 1 or 2 years. So it was probably the late 80s, younger than our children, because Michael got out of Notre Dame in 83, and Andrea and her now husband got out in 85. I think so. Jane probably was 86, 87, 88, but you'll meet her, and it'll probably be somewhere in the, she could probably be Googled for that part of it. Currently she lives in Alexandria, where she always lived. She married, after she was with our staff, she married Mark Chopko, and they have children. Mark is an attorney, and he represented the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops for a number of years, and represented them, interestingly enough, through all this crisis period of abuse. And so he was a very important member of the team that handled this whole upheaval of priestly abuse of young people. But Jane was another one who, now she was not like Sarah. Jane is more like Mike Nevins, more organized, more clipped, more prone to move along and move ahead and not do a lot of amenities and maybe not do, very, very pleasant, don't get me wrong, but she was more prone not to just sit back and chitter chat, but to get things done and move them along. So, you know, the staff probably reacted differently to her than to Sarah. I wouldn't consider Jane to have been at that time, particularly she was much younger, but I don't think she was by personality the one that you could, you know, get as close to as, say, Sarah. But did a wonderful job and saw me through to the end, and she supervised what you're doing right now. Jane was the one who supervised all the closing down of both offices. She supervised packing away of papers, getting in touch with the archives up there and getting in touch by the, you know, Bill Morrison was the one who quickly checked in with me about wishing the papers to be here at U of L. But Jane was the one who did all the lifting. There, Kathy may have some recollections of working with her. It may have been that Jane came to Louisville. I do not know, but she was the one who had that unhappy responsibility. Happy responsibility depends on how you look at it. Shutting down our office and, you know, giving the key away to the house superintendent and walking down the hall to a new life. And she's had a new life. She did work with organizations as well. I'm not as familiar with what she's done as I was with Sarah, but she continues. She's also very active with the Notre Dame Club. She was in the Notre Dame marching band, and so every year on St. Patrick's Day, the members of the Notre Dame marching band who live in the D.C. area, D.C., Maryland, Virginia, and some fly in, actually, and they march in Old Town, Alexandria, as part of the St. Patrick's Day parade. So Jane still tootles, you know, just like they say in those Irish songs, tootles a toot, and I'm not sure what it is. I think she played the piccolo. I think it was maybe something like that, one of the wind instruments. She might have been a percussionist, but she still is active in that. And we got together not terribly long ago for some pizza over in Alexandria with some of the remaining staff. So the ones who have left us, who I think are deserving of note here, Cecil Noel, I've mentioned him. Charlie has, I'm sure, talked about him. Charlie Mattingly has, I'm sure, talked about him. But Cecil was very important to our campaign. He was an advertisement, ad agency kind of person, public relations guy. And he had all of that personality that you would associate with a person who does advertising and who does public relations. Just a warm and genuine and wonderful and thoughtful guy with patience that never ended. We always used to kid that Cecil would sit with clients, well, really constituents, as he sat with his own clients, I guess. But he would sit with constituents for almost hours. We say, Cecil, you know, move. We have things to do. Well, he was just so devoted to people. Mm-hmm. The fact is, in his obituary, I spoke at his funeral mass. He became a convert to Catholicism while we were friends and co-workers, not because of any proselytizing I did, but because of a friend that we visit periodically who lives in Paris, Kentucky. But Cecil was just a genuine, wonderful fellow, and because he was with us through all the campaign, I knew him and knew him very well. And so the minute that we had won, I offered him right on the spot, as I did Charlie, some way to be with us, as I did the same thing with John Kilroy. And Cecil became the staff director in our Louisville office, so he was the first of those and did a great job. He was not like Bob and the lawyer types. He was not a lawyer. And he wasn't really devoted to anything into the policy side, and because I mentioned before, Louisville was not a policy office. Louisville was a personal office. Louisville was a caseworker, problem-solving kind of office. And it was like a hand in a glove. Cecil fit that perfectly. And he did his job of running the office very well as well. And he was such a nice guy that nobody could help but just love the guy. And he also became my personal friend. And he and I, and later when Charlie came along to that position, Cecil and I always went out together. I never went, and I can say this, in Washington as well as Louisville. I can't say that for Washington entirely, but in Louisville, I never went to anything during the work week or the work night where there was anything official that I did not have Cecil with me or Charlie or John Kilroy or somebody with me. And I did that consciously, both because they're my friends and it was always comforting. It gave me a pepper up as I'm going into some debate or going into some kind of a meeting that I wasn't relishing, but also because it gave me an opportunity to have someone drab the car while I can prepare my notes and get prepared for whatever lay ahead. And there was also a little bit of something in me that said, always have a witness, always have a witness. And these were loyal, wonderful people. They would never have lied for me. They would never have not told the truth about a situation. But I was always wary about going into somebody's house or going into some place without having someone with me who could verify this is exactly what happened. So I always went with someone. And Cecil then became my absolutely close friend. He was like my brother. We were contemporaries in age. Cecil was unlike me. Cecil was a very natty dresser. He was very careful about his attire. He used to sell shoes, so his shoes were always polished, as mine were because of my Army experience. I think I mentioned about the my friend Wade Dameron, who taught us a lot of things in the Army, including how to shine your shoes and keep them shined. But so Cecil always was a perfect front man for me. I mean, he went anywhere on my behalf, and people had to be say, well, you know, Ron Mazzoli picks a good, Cecil was a very nice looking man, very well dressed, but mostly Cecil was my dear friend, and he opened my office, and that's always tough. Also, John Kilroy, we've talked about John before in his campaign. He came with me when we first met in the Right to Life movement, Citizens for Decent Literature. We both were active in that, and so he became one of the first people to help in the state senate race, and then the mayor's race, and then the congressional race, and it was in a staff picture which we have. That's also going to come to the archives. A staff picture of John and Cecil and Charlie, John Kilroy and Cecil Noel and Charlie Mattingly and Brenda Sweat. She wasn't Sweat at the time. She was, her maiden name was different. And Diane Murrah, all in that first office, I think it was 551A in the federal building. So anyway, John was there at the, as we say, there at creation. That was, he was, if you talk about the Big Bang Theory, when the universe was created, John was there at Big Bang when I was created politically, I guess you'd say, and was with me the whole time. John had several functions. He was a wonderful caseworker, but not to solve the cases. John acquired the cases. John was like a magnet, and iron filings followed John's magnet. So wherever John was, people glommed onto him with this kind of a problem, that kind of a problem. And because he was Irish, he always wrote his papers with green ink, and you've probably seen some examples of his writing of green ink. He'd go to all the Democratic Club meetings, and he would take notes, and he would say, so-and-so is having a birthday, send him a cake. So-and-so has got a wife that's ill, send her a card. So John was a caseworker, but he was not the case solver. He was the acquirer, the gatherer of these cases, which then people like Brenda and Diane and Charlie solved, and later many other people, Lee and Brother Ken McCarthy. But he was a very important part of that. He was our eyes and ears in the community, a lovely man, well married, and they had five children, and each one of the kids, I see them periodically. They saw them all at John's funeral, which was a year ago. They all said that they'd hardly gotten out of diapers, and he had them walking neighborhoods, knocking on doors, and stuffing envelopes. I mean, we had the Kilroy Army, and it was nothing quite like it. So John was a great guy, great friend, a wonderful, devoted man of faith, and a good example to all people around us. Vicki Gagliardi, and Vicki was with me probably longer in some respects, but she and John were pretty well tied because Vicki was in that first law office I joined, and she was a secretary to Jerry Lloyd, and then Jerry affiliated with Fred Goldberg. But Vicki was there, and when I came to the law firm from the LNN, part of the deal was I got the part-time use of a secretary, and it happened to be Vicki. There were other secretaries in the office, and I got to know her and her husband Joe, and we talked about Joe with Joe last week. He's now in his mid-90s. He's blind. He lost his eyesight to glaucoma. He lost it at a time when they didn't have the techniques they have today, and I'm sure he would still be sighted if he had lived in a different era. But a wonderful man, lives on his own without sight. He still lives in his own home on Lexham. And right next door, a young couple have been very helpful to him, and Helen and I went out to have a cookout with them the other night. So we stay close to the family, Vicki, and in fact, Helen says Vicki was probably her closest friend outside her sister and outside family. So the one beautiful thing, Johnny, Kevin, if you see that, and when we talk it, you say, did this guy hire anybody but friends? I mean, did all these people become his close friends? How can that be? Well, these people all became my friends. They became Helen's friends. They became Mike and Andrea's friends. And that was the beautiful part of my life. That was the blessing that God gave me, was that these people were not only talented and energetic and hardworking and very loyal, very ethical, but they were friendly. They were good people. We got to love them. And so, that's been my life. That's been the good part. Just like this, if I can get across the river today, the young fellow who's running for treasurer of Indiana is also a guy we met casually, but has become a very close friend. And so that is the wonderful thing about my life. I have met and have a lot of very close friends. Vicki was with us, and I can't remember when she left. She retired. She eventually passed away, but it was her decision to retire. We would have kept her forever, it was, Cecil died during service. John Kilroy didn't. He died more recently, but Vicki left to retire and do some things. Her kids were still at home. They're gone now, but they're out of the city now. And the other one I'd wish to talk about for a minute is Olive Daddario, D-A-D-D-A-R-I-O. And I mentioned briefly the other day, but when it came to pass that I won with a landslide margin of 211 votes, I started getting calls from Washington, from Congressman Peter Rodino, who is the, you might say, chair of the Italian caucus, which is just that loose affiliation of members of Congress who are Italian-American, whose heritage is Italian. And he, as I mentioned before, said he didn't realize there were that many Italians here. And I said, well, I wasn't elected because I'm Italian as much as despite the fact that I am. And we got on to other topics. And then he eventually told me that when I was trying to staff my office, while Bob was doing the bulk of it, Peter told me, he said, there's a person I want you to work with if you possibly can. And it turned out to be Olive Daddario, whose brother Emilio, Mim Daddario, was a member of the House from Connecticut for a long time and had run that year, 1970, for governor of Connecticut. He was beaten by Tom Mescal, who served as governor and then became a federal judge. Olive had been working with her brother. Now, that's forbidden nowadays under the nepotism rules, but because she started working with Mim before the nepotism rule was invoked, she was grandfathered in, so she could stay working with him until he left. Well, she then was looking for something, and Peter Bordino joined the two of us together, and was that manna from heaven for me and for Helen. I mean, Olive became our close friend again. She was so watchful about me and my health. I think the reason I quit smoking, among many things, is because Olive was on Bob Bachman and me to quit smoking. It was just a vile habit, and it wasn't good for you. She was into health food. She always brought fresh fruit to the office, and she would make sure I had fresh fruit. And toward the end of the day, in order to build up my reservoir of energy, she would bring little wedges of cheese in with Triscuits, and I still eat Triscuits almost every day because of Olive. She also turned me on to VA juice. She wouldn't let me drink Coca-Cola. She made sure I had VA juice in the refrigerator. So she was like my mother. Olive was a young woman, older than I was at that time. I was 38, so I guess Olive was probably in her 40s at the time. But a tall, elegant, beautiful woman who just cared about all of us, cared about Bob, cared about me. When the kids would come in the office, Mike and Andrew, they would come up only on visits. They were still little at the time, and, you know, she would make over them. So Olive was just one of my heroes in the office, and she knew everything about the Hill. Having been with Mim, she knew every office. She knew every functionary in every office. She knew exactly what had to be done, A, B, C, D, E, F, successfully doing the case. And so we just were sort of in awe of this woman who was so wonderful and kind and gentle and sweet and also so knowledgeable and so professional. I mean, it was a peculiar and unusual combination, but Olive was special. She died. It was really very sad because she was, I guess you'd say, Christian Science. I think there's a term. I believe it's still that. But in effect, they sometimes don't believe in doctoring. They don't believe in certain kinds of medications and things like that. They believe in a sort of a holistic approach, which I tend to agree with myself. But apparently Olive got ill, and she insisted that she didn't want to go to doctors, and she tried to do this. And she eventually left us to live sort of in seclusion. It was really quite sad, a very gregarious and a very personable one, sort of pulled away and eventually died. But her brother Mim, I've seen him in a fairly recent vintage, not immediately, but fairly recent. And
how long was she with you?
Not many years. I would think probably she may have been with me like those 5 years that Bob Bachman was there, but probably not much longer. Helen would probably remember better than I would. And maybe the public record, you know, because she went off the payroll. So if we could probably, there's probably some repository of public pay records that you can access, because public record, public money. So it would, but my judgment, you know, but those were so important years because these little cards I carry, they're all a tribute to Olive. Every day I would have a card on my desk, and only typed up, not done like this. Every day there'd be a card like this on my desk, which suggested what I had to do, places I had to be, people I had to call. Always, and these little cards, 3x5 cards, have been with me since 1971. So, as I say, Olive has had a big influence on me, and let's move a little bit, Kevin, because you looked at, and I won't overwhelm you with data. These staff people are very important. I will talk a little bit about Wendell Ford. We've already talked about how important Wendell Ford, who was a state senator when I met him, became lieutenant governor and the presiding officer in the state senate when I was elected, then became governor, and then became U.S. senator. Wendell could have served, become president, as far as I'm concerned. He served in Congress very well, became assistant majority leader to Bob Byrd, I think it was, who was the majority leader at the time. So Wendell was everything. He's also our good friend. We just yesterday got a card, handwritten card from Wendell from his perch in Owensboro. He had been in Louisville at a fundraising dinner and had mentioned to the audience the wonderful relationship and friendship he had with Helen and me, and then told a couple of quick stories, one of which was that he didn't really so much care about me as he cared about Helen. And so when he would call us to have anything done, he would call and say, "Ron, hand the phone to Helen." And sometimes it would be when we're in bed. Wendell had these peculiar habits, probably still does, of calling like Carl Perkins would at, you know, 4 or 5 in the morning. I mean, these guys were constantly on the move. So anyway, he would call periodically and just ask me to hand a phone across the bed to Helen, you know, and so they'd have their conversations about this thing had to be done politically and this is what you... So anyway, it was, he just said it, he reflected on that about how important Helen was to him, his own political efforts. Of course, his most important political weapon is Jean, his beloved bride of these 50-plus years. And the other thing was we both found ourselves at the Mose Green Democratic Club, which was then up in Crescent Hill. And it was protocol and expected that any Democratic candidates looking for votes from the Moe's Green Democratic Club would buy some cakes for the cake wheel. Well, I didn't have any money, and Wendell only had a little bit, but we pooled what we had, and we're able to buy one cake for the cake wheel. So he reflected on that, you know, sort of like the sort of
Democrats?
Yeah, well, no, the way we got started, the simple start that Ron Mazzoli and Wendell Ford had, from a time when neither one of us had a couple of bucks in our pocket to the point that we were in the Washington and, you know, and that sort of thing. So Wendell brings up our humble beginnings, mm-hmm. in a way, with that story. And of course, he was helpful, as I mentioned before, about the UK tickets. When the reporter found me on the floor of the Senate that night and everybody else was down at Lexington watching the University of Kentucky ball game, and asked the question about why wasn't I there, and I said, well, I didn't want to get too close to any supplicant for money, and so that became a big front page story and all, mm-hmm. problems and this and that. Well, Wendell helped to kind of dampen the vibrations from that, and but he and Gene and Helen and I became great friends, and we continued that friendship in Washington. He was a mentor, just like I mentioned before, without going into further detail, about Frank Burke, what an estimable person Frank was, and what an outstandingly swift in the head political person he was, and how he saved me from making a fool of myself election night 1970 by just, mm-hmm. jumping out there and to say I've won. And also, he taught me a lot as we campaigned against one another in that mayoral primary. But again, a very important public figure who taught me a lot. Louis Nunn, a Republican, became Republican governor. What was also important to me in a sort of backhanded way, Louis, because in those days, Louis ran separate and apart from Wendell Ford. They were both elected. Wendell was elected lieutenant governor, Louis governor. Today, they run as a team. So you either elect a team or you don't elect a team. And
Louis Nunn was Republican,
Louis
and of
Nunn
course, Wendell
Republican,
Ford is a Democrat.
Wendell Ford was a Democrat. So Louis Nunn was elected the Republican governor, first one since LaFoon. Ruby LaFoon was the last Republican governor back in the 30s. But Louis was elected, and that meant that Wendell became the head of the Democratic Party. So that in a backhanded way, Louis did me a favor by beating Henry Ward, because if Henry had been elected, it would have been the same old, same old, same old. Same Democrats, same people. Guys like me would probably not have had much of a chance. But with Louis gone, Wendell, young and aggressive and active, and with his friend J.R. Miller, who ran one of the electric co-ops in Western Kentucky, they just took over the party and they moved it forward. Got rid of the deadwood and built a headquarters and all that type of stuff. And Louis caused that to happen. So I was very fond of Louis because of the backhanded way he helped me. I wouldn't have gone to Washington if Wendell and JR hadn't moved the party along. And I mean, it's just a fortuitous thing that I was elected when I was. If I had been elected to the state Senate, and I probably couldn't have been, you know, 4 or 5 years earlier, it wouldn't have been anything. I would have been part of a machine, and that's about it. Fewer 8 or 10 years later, I probably couldn't have been elected because of money problems and this and that and everything else. So I came along at the right time, and Louis made it easier. He and his wife Beulah, who broke up along the way, but he and his wife Beulah were fine. They were both nicely, they came from Glasgow, I think. But I mean, they were both given to good dress and good manners and elegant activities. And so they were fond of having balls, formal balls at the mansion. And the first formal ball that Helen and I ever attended was a ball that was hosted by Louis Nunn and Mrs. Nunn, the governor and the first lady. So that was a pretty cool thing. When you had these young kids from Louisville who had hardly ever been in a tuxedo, all of a sudden you're waltzing around the beautiful mansion in Frankfurt. So I think of Louis, and actually Helen and I hosted Louis to a University of Louisville football game over at Papa John's Stadium a few years back, honoring Louis for having been the governor that brought University of Louisville into the state system. You may not know this, Kevin, but for a long time, University of Louisville was a municipal school. It was not part of the state higher education system. It was separate and apart. And it needed to get into the state system in order to get proper funding and in order to have the stature and status that goes with being part of a network of state universities, the cooperation that goes with it. And so Louis was the one that brought U of L into the system, and they honored him, and it was Helen's and my happy pleasure to be his host and hostess that afternoon in one of the skyboxes over at Papa John. Now, Louis himself has passed away, and it's two people I'd mentioned along the way, John Sherman Cooper, who has been mentioned quite often recently because of the flap over Rand Paul, the new Senate nominee, the Republican Senate nominee, has said about the Civil Rights Act of 64. It happened that John Sherman Cooper worked very closely, and when Mitch McConnell, the current U.S. Senator, was the assistant to Cooper, worked very closely on getting the T's crossed and the I's dotted to get that Civil Rights Bill, that the Civil Rights Bill passed. And so his name has come into the print quite a bit, but John Sherman Cooper was another one of these remarkable people, elegant guy, along with his own wife, Lorraine, who was just, they had a salon, actually, and if you remember, they were very close friends with the Kennedys, John Fitzgerald Kennedy and Jacqueline Kennedy, and they had in Georgetown, as you know from Washington, that's where the beautiful mansions and all of the political and social salons are. And so they had one of those, and John Sherman Cooper had been ambassador to East Germany, ambassador to India. I mean, he was everything, and a confidant of all the presidents, and a U.S. senator. Well, John Sherman Cooper was at heart a Kentuckian, and he would show up even when he was senator, and even after he left the position, he'd show up at these breakfasts of the Farm Bureau Federation, or the electric co-ops, or the hog farmers. I mean, wherever it was, John Sherman Cooper was at heart of Kentucky, and that's where he was. And I'll never forget two things that happened. One was when I was elected, it's fairly commonplace to have a reception. And so we had our reception in I was in the Longworth building. My first office was 1017 Longworth, right in the basement. But because of Peter Rodino, who was chairman of the Judiciary Committee, I was able to get a room, a beautiful ornate room, in the Judiciary Committee hearing room as the site for my reception after being sworn in as a member of the U.S. Congress. And of course, my family was up there, including Helen's mother, Mrs. Dillon, who had Parkinson's, very, very difficult situation with Parkinson's over the years. Also at a time where there were very few medications. And so she was very much affected by the disease. And but she was there. She was a brave woman, a real soldier. I learned a lot from Ms. Dillon. We're members of a Parkinson support group, and even right now, in honor of her. But she was at this reception sitting in a wheelchair. And so we had a lot of our friends coming through, people that we expected to be there. All of a sudden, the door opens, and in walks this tall, he had beautiful white hair, just a good-looking man, John Sherman Cooper, a Republican. And here's a Democrat. And what had this Democrat done to be there? Had beaten a Republican congressman, had beaten one of John Sherman Cooper's allies and friends, Congressman Bill Calger. And here's John Sherman Cooper walking in the door to be part of our reception. I've never, ever forgotten that. And even beyond that sense of unity, that sense that Kentucky is what counts, not so much who wins and who doesn't, but Kentucky counts, was also the fact he made almost a beeline over to Mrs. Dillon. And he was a towering figure, tall man. But he bent over and was talking to Mrs. Dillon, who, as you know, because you're quite aware of Parkinson and its effect, had a hard time communicating. But he just stood there and was patient and talking and everything else. And I could never, ever forget John Sherman Cooper. Well, there were times later, because he would come to all of these breakfasts, all these Kentucky arrangements and get-togethers, and he'd always ask me about my mother. His understanding that day was that Mrs. Dillon was my mother. My mother was not there. But so he mistook that part, but he always remembered Mrs. Dillon. Always, all the years of his life, thereafter, wherever, he always asked about my mother, how's she doing? And I thought that was such a touching, wonderful thing. Well, John Sherman Cooper, for all of his elegance, was also known to be a little bit sort of eccentric and a little bit like the absent-minded professor and wasn't quite sure where he was and what to do. Well, once Helen and I were flying back to Washington, on I get probably Allegheny or Eastern back in the days when they had airlines, and John Sherman Cooper was on the plane. Well, so anyway, stood up, we got pulled into National Airport before it was Reagan National. Then he pulled into National, and I made this sort of casual. I said, Senator, would you happen to need a ride back to your house? Fully expecting him not to say yes. He said, well, certainly, thank you very much. And then I'm saying, how in the world are we going to do it? Because we had this Rambler, this little tiny car that was our automobile up there. And it had four doors, but it was just a tiny car. And so anyway, we get out of the airport, and lo and behold, I thought still John maybe has said that, but he'd get a cab, no cab. He was going to, so we get there, and he's this tall guy, you know, and he had to practically fold himself into the back seat of our car, which was not a beautiful looking car to begin with. And then so we take off. I know how to get to Georgetown, but only that. So I said, Senator, can you give me some idea where to go? He said, why don't you turn there? And so I turned there, and then I drive, and I said, Senator, what? He said, well, why don't you turn over here? And then I turn over here. So the long and short of it, he didn't know where he was, and I didn't know where I was, and we were just saying, well, why don't you take this? Turn right. Go ahead and turn right. And so it took us one day short of forever before I somehow stumbled on the street in which he lived, and he recognized his house. It's like one time I lost my car in the airport out there at Stanford Field, and a friend of mine just drove me around for a while until I saw the car. And so we just drove John Sherman Cooper around until we found his house. It was one of these elegant places, you know, like I said, a salon. But anyway, he went up to the front door, and we saw him in. So anyway, those are my recollections of a great guy.
Announcement that we had a break. Yes, we've had a break of a couple of minutes now, and we're continuing our conversation with the congressman on local figures.
Thank you very much. And as I mentioned about John Sherman Cooper, a Republican, coming in and making over Helen's mother, I just thought that was just so touching and so genuine of him. And also just a sign of genuine good manners. Well, another sign of genuine good manners was Marlo Cook. Marlo was the U.S. Senator at the time, had been, as your research probably points out, the county judge executive, working with Bill Calger. Calger was the mayor, Cook was the county judge executive, and Bill Cranfill was the sheriff, the three C's. I mean, they were young guys, and they took over the town, beat the Democratic machine. And Cook and Bill Calger worked together. They were blood brothers practically, and they were political allies. So here is Marlo Cook, a U.S. senator, having seen his good friend, William O. Calger, beaten by an upstart by the name of Ron Mazzoli. Now, I had known Marlo's wife's side of the family. They're a very prominent side of the family in the Catholic circles of Louisville. I had known Marlo only briefly because he was a county judge executive. I had probably met him. But Helen and I were amazed. After my election, we got this call from Marlo Cook's office. Would Congressman and Mrs. Mazzoli be interested in joining Senator and Mrs. Cook at their home in Arlington for a dinner? Well, we said, obviously wonderful. It's kind of nice, and certainly we would. So Arlington, as you may know or may not know, is very confusing. A lot of turning and twisting roads. Anyway, somehow or another, Ron Mazzoli found his way with that same Rambler that Senator Cooper had to corkscrew himself into. We found our way to Marlo's house. We fully expected to find a bunch of cars, you know, thinking this, you know, get together for a lot of fun. We walked into that house, Kevin, and the exact guest list was Ron and Helen Mazzoli. That was the guest list. So what Marlo and Nancy were doing was welcoming Ron and Helen to Washington, welcoming us to Congress, welcoming us to a city we'd never lived in, never even been in for the most part, welcoming us to the realities of the public life, how you handle it, how you maneuver yourself, they had children, younger children at the time, and as in our case, they're all grown now, but in that time, they were young, they had younger children. how do you accommodate family demands with political demands? I mean, and this was just the four of us talking over a dinner and then later over coffee. And amazingly, I had beaten his good friend. Hmm. Now, if you talk about a man, he could have been vindictive and said, this guy Mazzoli, I'll never do anything to help him. I have to be in a room with him because the delegation meets, but that's going to be the end of it. There's going to be no warmth or fealty among us, between us. That's how it's going to be. He beat my buddy. But it wasn't that way at all. And so I learned a lot from that. I learned a lot from Cooper, because he could have been with all the able-bodied people in that room, and he did. He did a good job at my reception, but he particularly tarried with Helen's mother, which I thought was so affecting and so touching. And Marlo and Nancy could have had, if they decided to have something to welcome us, it could have been lunch in the Senate dining room. Perfunctory, there you are, there you go, in their home.
Invisible,
that's right, in their home. And I learned many things from Marlo from that. One is good manners you have to have at all levels, even when you're bitterly disappointed, as he might have been. I mean, he and Calgary may not have been absolute bosom buddies, but obviously it had to be a hurt to him politically, if nothing else, that a Republican got lost. But good manners prevail. Good breeding prevails. A good understanding of the responsibility of persons toward their commonwealth prevailed here. And I learned that. And I learned also a lesson which sounds a little ridiculous, but it's very true. He said, Ron, he said, let me give you one last piece of advice. He says, stay away from paperclips. And I thought he said, read this book, read the Washington Post carefully, start reading the New York Times, stay away from this guy, he's nothing but bad news. But he said, stay away from paperclips. What he meant, and it's been true, it happened to me last night. He said, paperclips have the unfortunate tendency of picking up paper that they're not meant to pick up. Which is to say, if you're trying to get a bunch of papers together, all of a sudden the paperclip picks up the back papers and you can't find the papers you're looking for. So to this day, I am called Mr. Stapler. I have a stapler at every place I am, and to the extent I can, I have a staple remover because I'm stapling everything, which means to add something to the pile, unlike taking the paperclip off and putting the paperclip back on, I got to unstaple the stuff. Mm-hmm. Or you have this wrapped rim of steel there that isn't very easy on the fingertips. So anyway, Marlo Cook probably taught me one of my, along with the more important element of being friends and of good manners and of having the decency that he had, the civility that he had, and Nancy as well. They now live in Sarasota, Florida, and have for many years. But he's still active and still wrote a piece, I think, in the 2008 elections. He supported Obama, and he wrote a wonderful piece for the Courier-Journal. You might be able to look it up in the morgue, talking about the advantages, you know, and in effect, going against his own president, you know, going against George W. Bush. So Marlo was that way. Marlo called him as he saw him, and received quite a bit of notoriety because he was the chairman of the Senate Rules Committee, which is a sort of obscure committee. In the House, it's a very important committee. In the Senate, it's a sort of like a ceremonial committee. And so Marlo was always on the dais when the presidents were sworn in. And he's always in these many pictures. I guess it would have been Richard Nixon. That was in 72, I guess. And Richard Nixon in 68, possibly. So he was on there quite a bit. But anyway, the primary lesson was that lesson, civility. But the other lesson was stay away from paper clips. Use the stapler. So anyway, even today, people can't see this, but you can see the card, which is an effective memento to Olive Diderio. The staplers that I have everywhere I live, all the desks, all the drawers have staplers, a tribute to Marlo Cook.
A great story. Well, we've been at this for just a little bit over an hour, and I know that you have a busy day still in front of you. We'll make an attempt to pick it up later in the afternoon if that's possible. We've looked at your staff members, and we've looked at local political figures of note. And in the afternoon, if we can meet, we'll take a look at national figures of note and international personalities that you have met in the course of your congressional service, and any other things that your remarkable memory will allow us to access.
I think you're going to be visiting with a remarkable memory tomorrow with Charlie Mattingly, and I think you'll see remarkable memories when you visit my other people, including Dan Hall. For me, I forget things quicker than I can remember them, but it is interesting when you put names on paper, the little vignettes that somehow come back to even a tortured brain like mine. So, but it's always a pleasure, Kevin, and we will pick this thread up later.
Today is Monday, May 24th, 2010. This is Kevin Collins, and today's interview, a continuation of this morning's interview, is with Romano Mazzoli, the former congressman for 12 terms from 1970 to 1994 for the 3rd Congressional District of Kentucky. It is being recorded at the University of Louisville Archives as part of the Romano Mazzoli Oral History Project. Good afternoon, Congressman.
Good afternoon, my friend Kevin. And if my voice seems to have changed between the morning session this afternoon, I just came back from a foray across the Ohio River to Clarksville, Indiana, where I made a what you might call a campaign appearance for a young friend of mine, and we probably will speak about him too, Peter Buttigieg, who was a student at Harvard when we were up there and whose career we followed when he was completing his Rhodes Scholarship over at Oxford. And so anyway, he's running for the position of state treasurer of Indiana. So he was appearing across the river, so I thought I'd try to hop in the car. I almost didn't make it. I got lost over there, that maze of interstate highways and state roads, and I pulled off in a little shopping center, and happily the people at a credit union were wonderfully gave me proper instructions, so I got there quite on time.
But maybe it's Senator Sherman Cooper when you need him for directions.
Well, isn't that the truth exactly? Having talked about John Sherman, take a left here, take a right. That's about what I did. And I wound up probably, I'd never gotten back, but anyway. Yeah, we talked earlier about memorable people in the sort of state and local vein or within the context of Kentucky's delegation to Congress. And possibly to shift gears, it might be interesting to talk about some of the, what I would call national or international figures whom I've had the opportunity to meet, and particularly those whom I've had an opportunity to work with. And starting with the president, we might just sort of categorize presidents first and then possibly the speakers of the House. And I served with 6 presidents in my career from 1971 to 1995, but actually only 4 speakers. So the tendency of speakers to stay in office is, you know, goes beyond the presidents. Now, some of the shifting in the presidents were because of President Nixon's resignation and President Ford's accession to office, and he was a new president, and nobody really knew him, and so he wound up losing to Jimmy Carter in that election. But anyway, the 6 presidents, President Nixon was the first one, and a very controversial man in lots of ways. But the two things that, three things actually, I guess, that really struck me about Richard Nixon was the fact that at all stages of his life, he really was profoundly in love with his wife. And I thought that expression of love and affection between the Nixons was pretty important, particularly in a town like Washington, where a lot of times marriages get riven and relationships are broken because of the allure of politics and because of the helter-skelter. But I thought that was pretty impressive that he stayed with his wife. And the other thing was probably the first night, maybe the second night we were in Washington after my election and swearing in, President Nixon had all of the new members of Congress down to the White House for a reception, a black tie type reception. Once again, he was very much, as I mentioned about Governor Nunn and his wife, the Nixons were prone to use a very elegant affairs, very, very well crafted affairs, were dress up affairs, I guess we want to call them that. And I'll never forget that Helen and I were there in the White House. That was, I think, our very first time in the White House. We had looked at it probably as tourists. We possibly had been in it as tourists, but never to be in it as a part of the place. And so here we were in this beautiful ceremonial room. I think it was the East Room. And President Nixon, they had set up a receiving line, and always you have these protocol officers, military people, who are standing next to the first couple and telling them who's coming along, and because we've in the meantime told them who we are and what this sort of thing. So when it came our turn, we told the Marine Guard that it's Congressman and Mrs. Romano Mazzoli from Louisville, Kentucky. He told that to the Nixons, and immediately President Nixon, knowing that I had beaten a Republican, one that he had worked with, I guess, at some point, he said, "Oh yes," he said, I know of you. I know of you. You won the seat there that had been held by Congressman Calgar." And I said, "Yes." And so anyway, right from the get-go, it was pretty fascinating to say a president who actually knew me, or at least knew what I had done. Maybe didn't know me in a personal way, but he knew me in a political way as having won that office. And then later, after he passed away, I was one of many members who took advantage of the opportunity to fly to Loma Linda to take part in his funeral. And if I'm not mistaken, every living president at that time was there. And that would be President Ford, President Carter, President Clinton, presidents. Let me see. Anyway, all the living presidents, and I can't call every single one of them, but President Reagan, I guess, was still alive at that time, and George Bush, George Herbert Walker, and we were there out there in Loma Linda, and I thought that was very important because here you had all of the people coming together, people who in lifetime objected to what Richard Nixon stood for, and they fought with what he stood for. And so in the last analysis, he was there as a person everybody paid respect to, and I thought that was a perfect ending. He, of course, became quite a person of knowledge about foreign affairs to whom most of the sitting presidents paid court at some point. It was sort of contradictory to what you would expect in that he had left Washington in disgrace. He had left Washington more or less before the posse rode in, having resigned to avoid certain charges. But he was such a powerful intellect and such a knowledgeable person that all the presidents, those who, like Bill Clinton, criticized him heavily, and those who didn't criticize him, like President Ford, all took counsel with him. President Gerry Ford, was a member of the House. When I got there, he was a minority leader of the U.S. House of Representatives and a person that, like every other member, you know by first name, so he was known as Jerry. He wasn't Mr. Ford, and he wasn't minority leader Ford. He was Jerry. And so you got used to seeing him and working with him. He was quite an athlete when he was at University of Michigan, played a lot of football, and he continued to play sports. And I remember at one point in the years that he was there, which were not many, before he went to the White House, but he had his leg in a big cast. He had broken a bone or had sprained something, so it was kind of like that athletic after effect. The better the athlete, sometimes the quicker the bones and sinews and joints fail to work. But a very pleasant man, and he and his wife, of course, were very close, and Betty Ford was the one who really kicked off the national discussion about breast cancer and about alcoholism, and very difficult in those days to talk about either one of them publicly. I mean, they just were sort of verboten. But Betty did, and Gerald Ford followed her. And while he lost the election, I think now most people think that he did the country a favor, though he suffered for it. But he did the country a favor by pardoning Richard Nixon and getting that whole thing done, that dark chapter, as he called about it, close it. And I think everybody agrees that, on retrospect, that was probably well done. But otherwise, a good person who, because he was a former member of the House, used to come back to the gymnasium, as I'll mention in a minute about George Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush, who would come back to the gymnasium and work out with the guys and play paddleball with them and So it was kind of interesting. He felt very close to Ford because of that relationship. Very much contradictory to Ford was Jimmy Carter. Now, Jimmy Carter was, as you know, a nuclear engineer, went to the Naval Academy, was all a product of that discipline. In those days when really the Naval Academy was like a monastery, as the Air Force and Military Academy, and studying nuclear physics and calculus and all the things you have to study to become a nuclear engineer made Carter very, very organized to the point of being almost obsessed by organization. And it was found that he used to actually control the schedule of the White House tennis courts. I mean, a president of the United States worrying about war and peace, and he was out there trying to schedule who was going to be on the tennis court. But that was his grasp of the minutia, but it's also the minutia which really, I think, eventually made him a one-term president. Now, it could be that attention to detail and that doggedness that he showed to control everything, to have his finger in everything in the White House, may have allowed him to become, as many people say, the best former president that we've ever had. With Habitat for Humanity and, of course, the Carter Center and these jets around the world, even in his mid-80s, and monitors elections and sometimes says he sticks his nose into business he shouldn't stick it into. He's not the friend of all the presidents because he's marauding around doing his own foreign policy and not necessarily with their permission or with their approval. But he does what he wants to do, and he doesn't really care. Prolific writer. But also, interestingly enough, despite this sort of humility of carrying his own suitcases through that election and sleeping in houses and sacking out on studio couches, carrying his own luggage, he really, I don't think I don't really think he's either a simple person. I think he's a very complex person. Nor do I think he's a humble person. I think he's a pretty arrogant person. But sometimes arrogance is what you need to get a job done. When your name is Jimmy Carter and you come from the peanut state of Georgia and you want to be president, I mean, that's a pretty arrogant thought. Pretty arrogant. And he was able to pull it off because of all these other traits and characteristics that he has of doggedness and perseverance and tenacity. But it also made him a very difficult person to work with. President, I remember early, Tip O'Neill was saying, was very disparaging of Carter because Carter wanted to control everything about the inauguration, all the tickets, and just like he controlled the White House tennis courts and things like that. He had an aide with him. He came into the White House with him. Jody Richards was one. I can't call his name, a writer who stayed on in Washington, and Hamilton Jordan. Mm. But in the South, J-O-R-D-A-N is pronounced Jordan, just like the coach at Auburn, the fabled football coach at Auburn, Shug Jordan. Well, anyway, Hamilton Jordan was in the White House, and he was one of these people who was controlling what was going on with tickets. And so the story goes, how true it is, I don't know, but the story goes that Tip O'Neill or had somebody in his office call the Carter White House and wanted some more tickets for the inauguration. Sorry, Mr. Speaker, you only have so many tickets, and that's what you're going to stick with. So they stiffed Tip O'Neill, the speaker. They stiffed him. So from that point on, this guy, Hamilton Jordan, was known by Tip as Hannibal Jerkin. And you know, the whole idea that Hamilton becomes Hannibal and Jordan becomes Jerkin. So that was the way Tip got back at that. It took him a long time to really straighten out. Mm-hmm. And Carter, for a long time, I think probably through his presidency, was one of these very, very self-controlled guys. He was determined. Sometimes I think, you know, there's a lot of ego that was thrown into that. But he didn't make very much headway with the Hill because of his own personal approach to things and the approach of the people around him. But again, to give the man credit, he's written extensively. He's helped to bring some degree of peace or at least a democratic process to elections around the world. And he has promoted Habitat for Humanity steadily over the years, and I think has made some things better for people in America, even as he is a former president. Mm-hmm. Came Ronald Reagan. and came the antithesis of Jimmy Carter. It sort of reminds me of the courses I took at Harvard about the history of the place and all the many presidents it's had. And Peter Gomes, Dr. Gomes, who teaches it, and who's also the professor of religious studies at Harvard, and he's the minister in Memorial Church, so he has two or three different titles and functions. But his course on the history of Harvard says that when the corporation, which is what they call the president and fellows of Harvard College, which is the group that runs Harvard University, when the corporation gets together to pick a successor to the president, they look at that president, the failures, the successes, the strengths, the minuses, and pick somebody to fill in those gaps. And so I think here somehow the people may have picked in Reagan somebody to fill the gaps left by Jimmy Carter, a man with very little, if any, personality, a man with very little, if any, a personal feeling about other people, a very clinical kind of guy, very cold, very much prone to determining things based on the scientific side, not so much the personal human side. And here you get a guy like Reagan who comes riding in from the West, and great voice, great persona, friendly guy, Irish guy, tells jokes, fun person to be with, has views that some Democrats thought were aberrant and befitting of Caligula more than a current president. But here was a guy that nobody could help but like. And so I don't know whether the people of America consciously chose somebody different than Jimmy Carter, or whether it was just one of those moments in time where things shifted and the tectonic plate shifted and they gave you President Reagan. But what a delight to work with. I was the first time, and the only time I ever went to Camp David was when President Reagan invited some of us to come up to hear more about one of his programs. He was also extraordinarily devoted to the idea of immigration reform, and we would not have gotten the bill except that President Reagan really poured himself into it. And he was a guy that would have us down to the White House as well. He and his wife, of course, were very much into the elegant side of entertaining, and with the clinking glasses and things of that nature. And it was Reagan, I think it was twice when President Reagan was president, that Helen and I went to state dinners at the White House, which are like a trip in some magic carpet. It's like Arabian Nights with all of this gold and brocade and crystal and silver and things like that. Pretty amazing experience to go to a White House state dinner. And I think it was twice when President Reagan was there. Once when Brian Mulroney, the Prime Minister of Canada, was in town, and once when the President of Italy, it might have been Andreotti or somebody from Italy, was in town. And so we went to the state dinners. But President Reagan, I have a picture of him on my wall at home in November the 6th of 1986, signing into law the Immigration Reform Bill, the Simpson-Mazzoli Bill. And because of those contacts, and the contacts, because his vice president was George Herbert Walker Bush, and so had an opportunity to get to know that man before he became himself president. So that was also an interesting opportunity. And some of the staff people around President Reagan were talented people that I enjoyed working with. Came what we call Bush 41, Bush number one, Herbert Walker Bush, became president in 86. And once again, I'd known him, and so we'd worked together on the immigration bill, so we worked together on a few things. But mostly what I remember about George Bush is that he was quite an athlete. When he was at Yale, he was the first baseman and captain of their baseball team, and he really was a first-class athlete. And so it was his custom, as a former member of the House — he was in the House before I got there, before he went to the head up the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency, and before he became ambassador to the United Nations, and then eventually vice president, and then president. But he was a member of the House of Representatives in that era. And just as in the case of President Ford, as a former member, you're accorded privileges of the gymnasium. Well, with Ford, it wasn't as prominent or as noticeable. But when President Bush, because again security over the years improved and was unfortunately improved because conditions in the world became more tense and dangerous. So more and more as the presidents moved around, they had larger and larger entourages of security. So when President Bush would come to the House gym, which was pretty often, all of us knew it. Because you went to this door, which isn't marked particularly, but it's the door that takes you into the House gymnasium, and which incidentally is now called the Wellness Center. It's a euphemism for gymnasium because gymnasium sounds too, you know, too much of a perk, and Wellness Center sounds like your hard work to keep yourself well. Anyway, when you're there and you saw these guys, these tall, good-looking, very stern-looking, unemotional-looking men standing at the door, going into the gym, and always they had, they're talking into their wrists, you know, talking into those microphones, stuff sticking out of their ear, you knew darn well that George Bush was afoot. So they wouldn't impede you, you know, they'd wave you in. But when you got in there, you see George Bush out there just doing his exercises, and he had no special place cordoned off to dress or undress. He was doing it with everybody else. And so it's pretty unusual, to say the least, where you might be taking a shower almost next. That shower do have cubicles. They weren't gang showers. But it is pretty different to, you know, change clothes and get into your gym outfit when you got a president of the United States, you know, a few yards away or a few feet away. So, but he was a good guy. Everybody liked him. He may not go down in history as one of the great presidents, and probably won't, but well appreciated by the members of the House and considered to be a helpful fellow.
Let me ask you, at the time that that President Bush, number one, before he was president, headed up the CIA, did that coincide with your service on the Select Committee on Intelligence?
Not really. That was before he. That was even before I was in Congress when he was CIA director. And the CIA director, when I was there on the committee, was Bill Casey, and William Casey, called him Mumbles because he intentionally mumbled everything so that you could halfway never understand what the guy was saying. And we thought that was a defense mechanism. Here's a guy that, without deviating too much, but this is a fellow who went to the best schools and founded a book publishing company, became a multimillionaire, head of the SEC, all of these wonderful positions in Washington, and then heading up to CIA, and it was he who just sort of mumbled everything, so you just honestly almost couldn't understand what he was telling you at these intelligence committee meetings, and we always thought it was done on purpose, almost like some of the South Carolinians, guys like Strom Thurmond and Mendel Rivers and those folks. There's a kind of language in South Carolina along the coastline called Gula. I think it's G-U-L-L-A-H, which is a sort of mishmash of African-American dialects and English dialects and Southern drawl dialect, but it all kind of concocts into what's called Gula. And the South Carolinians would on purpose, I think, or maybe it was not on purpose, but they would use that sing-songy, mushy way of speaking like they had stuff in their mouth all the time to say things on the floor, and you could never say pretty much what they went on. And there's another one from Mississippi who did the same thing, Bill Colmer. But anyway, George Bush was the head of the CIA at one phase in his life, but that was before I really got to Congress. Then came Bill Clinton, President Clinton, of course, beat George Herbert Walker, Bush 41. And actually, as we now find out, it set up the battle when George W. Bush, the former president once removed, beat Bill Clinton. Beat his hand-picked nominee, Al Gore. It's sort of like a retribution because George W. Bush saw that Clinton had beat his dad, and you know, he sort of decided he was going to write the books at some point, and apparently did. Well, Bill Clinton, Miles has been written about him, and Miles Moore will be written about him. An amazing guy, an amazingly intelligent man, amazingly adroit politician, an amazingly an energetic guy. He never seemed to stop, even now in his, mid-60s possibly, or early 60s, with heart problems and everything else, he still keeps like the energizer buddy. He keeps on moving along. But I seriously disagreed with Bill Clinton many times. I think that his running around with the intern was a scandal. I think that he demeaned the office and demeaned himself and his family. Not a role model that I think a president ought to be for young people or old people or any people. And as in the case of people like George Wallace, who after they more or less reformed themselves, did a lot of good for the country, but the only thing you ever heard when George Wallace died was George Wallace, former governor of Alabama, the man who stood in the schoolhouse door, passed away, XYZ. For Bill Clinton, it's going to be something, the same thing, the 41st or 42nd president of the United States, but he'll be the only president who was impeached, and he was a president who had an affair with an White House intern. That's not the way I think the history should have been written. So given all of that flaw, Clinton probably, pound for pound and inch for inch, is probably the most effective politician I've ever seen in action. The man has a gift for words. He has a gift for remembering people and names and places and for seizing on the moment in ways that not many politicians can seize. And so, like I say, sometimes it's almost like the Greek playwrights. They write about people with gigantic flaws, they have hubris. They bring themselves and their families to their knees, but are people of immense accomplishment in the process. So but he was a memorable president. I was there just for one part of his term, long enough to see him right the office, in a sense, because the office was shaking in the spring of 93 and trying to get a budget. And that budget was the one that claimed a lot of political victims, mostly this member Marjorie Margolis Mizvinsky, who cast the one fatal last vote to get the budget across and who lost her seat the next time around. And so even as we talk in 2010 about the midterm elections this coming November, people are thinking that those people who cast votes for the health care reform and possibly even the stimulus bill may be like Marjorie, who I see periodically as I go back to Washington. They may be like Marjorie, have done maybe a noble thing in their mind, but maybe throwing themselves in the funeral pyre in the process. Mm-hmm. But we'll see.
Let me ask you quickly then, as you survey the presidents that were in office in the time you were in Congress, and I know that the problems shift and the time and the circumstances shift. In your estimation, who do you think was the most effective of the presidents?
Well, from the standpoint of getting things done, I would probably have to say President Reagan, because he took on the budget. Remember, he was the first one to come in to start talking about cutting government back and making changes and getting us on a sounder footing. And he was able to put that across. I mean, it may or may not have been absolutely successful, but that was a major venture that he took. And then the other one was immigration, which I worked on very closely, which is very controversial and hard to produce. President Nixon started the war against cancer, which is still going on. He flawed himself because of Watergate. President Ford did not have a long time in office and is probably not notable for presidential achievements, maybe beyond his being the bridge between the Nixon years and then later the Carter years. He sort of bridged that gap and gave the country a breath of fresh air and some sunshine instead of dark light. President Carter, he got trapped in the Rose Garden. He made this pledge he was going to be in the White House until the hostages were released in Tehran, and they were not released, and he just stayed captive. And some say that's why he lost the race to Ronald Reagan, in part because he limited his ability to get out and about, because he was going to be. So he was a very headstrong, contrary kind of guy, and I don't know that he really got much done. But again, you may be able to check the record. Reagan got a lot done. Some people say he didn't do a lot right, but he got a lot done. Bush was once again sort of a bridge factor. George Herbert Walker, number one, was sort of a bridge factor. At this point, I cannot think of a major initiative. Obviously, they get budgets passed and things like that. Bill Clinton did did get his budget passed, and then later he had welfare reform, and he had some bills like that that got things done. President Clinton, in his first term, I think, had that wonderful meeting of Yitzhak Rabin and Anwar Sadat, I think, in the White House. We were all down there for that. And I think under Bush 1 was when the first Gulf War ended, and we had the big march down, all of the troops coming back, marched down Pennsylvania Avenue. And Norman Schwarzkopf, who became a folk hero during that period of time. So there were highlights, and Clinton obviously went on to do a lot of things. But my part was really the immigration.
Just as a note for the record, Norman Schwarzkopf was the general in charge of the war.
That's the first Gulf War, yes.
First Gulf War.
Actually, it's interesting. There are six presidents, but only four speakers. We talked about that momentarily. And the first of the speakers was Carl Albert, who was the whip or majority leader to the outgoing speaker, John McCormick, from your home state of Massachusetts. And John McCormick was one of those legendary speaker-type figures. And Carl Albert was his associate when when the speaker retired, then Congressman Albert became Speaker Albert. Mm-hmm. And John McCormick, I believe he left voluntarily. He was certainly not beaten. I think he just retired and left. So Carl Albert became Speaker. And I'll never forget the fact that we had like a caucus, because it's the caucus that selects, the Democratic caucus selects its nominee to be Speaker, and then the entire House votes on the position. But it's the caucus that has the numbers, and so which one we select is the one who becomes speaker. And when we had our caucus, which was one of the first caucuses I had ever sat in on, and it happened that I'm not sure who was a tally clerk at the time. It might have been Fishbait Miller. It could have been Dan Rostenkowski on the bench. Announced the vote that the caucus had selected Carl Albert to be our nominee for speaker. And then I looked, and there was Carl Albert. He was a very diminutive man, not a very big man at all. Brilliant, a Rhodes Scholar in his own right. I think he came from Bug Tussle, Oklahoma, which has been renamed Flower Mound. Bug Tussle was just a little bit much for even those folks, so I think it's now called Flower Mound, Oklahoma. But anyway, Carl Albert was small in stature, but he was broad and big and powerful in intellect and in knowledge of American history, and in his oratorical skills. I think, as a matter of fact, his Rhodes was probably won as much because of his oratory, his ability to speak as the earlier speakers, like Daniel Clay Henry Clay, and who's the one from your home state?
Tip O'Neill?
I was thinking of way, way back in the early part of our country, where speakers spoke at length, and it'll come.
Webster.
Yes, exactly. So he spoke in that way, that sort of orotund, those very well-chosen phrases. But a very good man and a very good speaker, and I enjoyed working with him. Then came Tip O'Neill, who was all of the speakers, my very favorite, because everybody loved Tip O'Neill. He was colorful. He was the real deal. He was Cambridge, and he never was anything but Cambridge, despite all of his lofty positions and third in line for the presidency and all that. He was still one of those legendary pub crawlers in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and he played around with Whitey Bulger and all that gaggle of people when they would have their St. Patrick's Day dinners and affairs. Well, Tip was assistant to Carl Albert, and then he became, I should really back up a little bit, because the one who would have been speaker was killed, and that was Hale Boggs, Lindy Boggs' husband. And Hale was the majority leader, and in the way the House kind of operates, at least in those days, the majority leader would, when Albert had decided to call it a day, would have succeeded to that office. But Hale Boggs went up to Alaska to campaign for Nick Begich, whose son is now serving in the Senate. But the campaign for Nick Begich, who was in my class, that was that first year, that 1970, for re-election, and the plane was lost somewhere in Alaska, and they never have found the plane, never found the bodies. And so Hale was no longer, and of course Hale Boggs, as you know, is the father of the lady who's on National Public Radio and on television.
Yes, I can see her face. Again, I can't think of her name.
Yeah, isn't that terrible?
But she's also,
it must be
a lot
the
of
afternoon.
Shows
she
on
really,
television.
Exactly right. And so anyway, Hale would have been president had he lived, but O'Neill did become president. And I mean, he would have become speaker. And then O'Neill did become speaker. And he had a lot of interesting ways about him. Of course, he was Irish, and he was fun, and he was he knew how to a good Irish joke, and he enjoyed a good Irish whiskey drink, you know. And so, you know, the story goes that he and Ronald Reagan settled a lot of their problems over bourbon and branch water, if you will, or Irish whiskey and Irish jokes. But he was interesting. He roomed with Eddie Boland. Eddie Boland was from Springfield.
Massachusetts,
thank you, and the first chairman of our intelligence committee, and a wonderful man. Well, he and Tip roomed together for all those years, and they always went back to Boston at the end of the week. They never did really move their families, and Millie, Tip O'Neill's wife, never did move to Washington until after he was elected speaker, and then she didn't really spend all that much time in Washington either. But until that time, those two guys roomed together in some place. I can't even know where it was, maybe some little apartment on Capitol Hill. And the story goes that the only thing that you found in the refrigerator were cigars. Both of them were cigar smokers back in the days when that was the thing to do and everybody did it. And you did it in public, you know, not just furtively in private, but you did it in public. So in a way, that was Tip O'Neill. You know, he was one of those gregarious guys that practiced politics from the people standpoint, and of course, you know as I do, Kevin, one of the great political axioms of all time is all politics is local, and that was attributed to Tip, whether he actually invented it or not, I do not know, but the phrase fit him perfectly, because for him, politics wasn't presidents, politics was not White House, politics wasn't these traveling diplomats in striped pants and cutaway morning coats. It wasn't lifting your little finger when you had high tea at 4 o'clock and had your crumpets and so forth. Politics for him were people. Mm-hmm. The little people, the working class people, the moms, the dads, the parking lot attendants, the barbers, the pub keepers, the small business people. And those are the ones he frequented constantly in Cambridge all of his years. So I learned a lot. All of us learned a lot from Tip O'Neill, both how you bridge gaps politically, which is to be a person of good humor and to be a person whose word was his bond, never giving up his own beliefs about politics, his own doxology about good and bad of politics, but at the same time being able to let somebody else, you know, be part of the solution, of the equation when you're finally finished, where sometimes now people want to be the whole thing. They don't want to give anybody else credit. But Tip did that, and I enjoyed working with him. There are two people who came to campaign for me in that first era. One was Hale Boggs, came to Louisville before I was elected. And then the other one who came to Louisville was Tip O'Neill to appear for me on Main Street at one of those remodeled buildings on West Main Street. And I think that Tip came after I was elected. Hale came before I was elected. Hale came during my campaign. So those two people will have a particularly heavy place in my heart because they were there when this whole thing started. My next speaker was Jim Wright, who had worked with Tip O'Neill. And Tip decided to retire and I guess go back home, whatever it was. I know his son Tom had a pretty good-sized lobbying firm in Washington and so forth, but my recollection is Tip decided just to step aside, and Jim Wright, who was his lieutenant, ran and was elected, but by one vote. There was a fellow by the name of Phil Burton, who I think it was Phil, who campaigned, and I think Jim Wright won by one single vote. Once again, that's a caucus position, so the Democrats would elect it. That did not have to be approved by the House. That was strictly a party a Democratic Party position.
Mr. Wright was from Texas?
He was from Texas, from Fort Worth, Texas. And I think he is still alive and still teaching political science, and I think it's a Texas Christian, if I'm not mistaken. But his hometown was Fort Worth. And a very talented speaker, one of the best speakers I've ever heard in the House. Another man who studied deeply the art of politics, and he was able to speak to that with very few peers, to say the least, and almost no superiors. He, however, had his problems in a sense. He was pretty autocratic in his ways. Unlike Tip, he didn't have the personality that Tip had. He pretty much wanted things done in the Democratic way. He was one of the, you know, from the prairie. He was one of those prairie populists, and along with Wright Patman and I mentioned earlier Henry Gonzalez and some of those people who really felt that the Democratic Party was it. Its policies were the only real policies. Everything else stood aside. And it made it pretty hard for him to work. And then he had these problems with Newt Gingrich because Jim had written some books and something about the royalties on those books was somewhat in question. I've forgotten all the details because he was too good a guy to have to be brought down because of things that nowadays would be probably not really even notable. But he was, and Gingrich began what amounted to his own campaign to become a leader in the Republican Party and a leader in the House of Representatives. He began by just basically a steady crescendo of criticism of Jim Wright. And eventually, I guess Wright felt that his career was being impeded and interrupted too much, so he resigned, if memory serves me correctly, and then Tom Foley succeeded to his office as Speaker. And Tom was the last Speaker during my era, but it was interesting. Tom and Heather, his wife, were people very pleasant to be with. Tom was a big, tall, shambling fellow who had a lot of Irish personality. He comes from Spokane, Washington. And he was an audiophile. He, in his offices, he had the most elaborate kinds of audio equipment that you could imagine. Quite knowledgeable about that stuff. And he had the same name as one of the commanding generals out at Fort Knox, Thomas Foley. And so one day I had the pleasure of introducing Major General Thomas Foley to House Speaker Tom Foley. And they had a pretty good interest trying to figure out if those guys were related. I once traveled with Tom. We took a trip to Europe, and a very pleasant person to be traveling with. He was a successful speaker as a speaker, but once again, that's when Gingrich was in the ascendancy. And if you remember, it was in 1994. I had said I was not going to run in that election of 94. Last one I ran in was 92. I remember being in my district office in Louisville here the morning after the elections of 1994, which saw the Republicans take over the House and Gingrich in a few weeks to become Speaker of the House. And Tom Foley lost. Tom Foley got beaten in that race in 1994. And I remember talking to Tom on the phone because he was a good man and a friend. And I mean, to see a Speaker lose an election, it would have been tough. I told Tom, I said, you know, Tom, in a way, this is very painful, but in a way, it might be the best thing that could happen. We lost control of the House. You would have to come back as a member of the minority. You would not come back as Speaker. You'd have to sit out there with the rest of us. Somebody else would be in the chair that you've been in for years and years. And it would be, to me, it would be almost more painful than just gritting your teeth and accepting the fact that, who knows, the voters of the state of Washington made a terrible error, or somehow, some way, maybe because of being Speaker, I was not able to get back home as much. Whatever the justification for the people not electing him. But it'd be almost easier to try to handle that than to come back as in the minority. Only a few people made that transition smoothly. One was Harold Volkmer of Missouri, and I ran into Harold the other day. He was in town for a meeting of the NRA about a year ago. He and his wife passed away, and his new wife and he are active in the NRA. Anyway, Harold made the move to minority smoothly, and he was railing away at this and that and just as comfortable as when he was in the majority. And the other one was Barney Frank, who's been my friend for quite a long time, and he made the smooth transition. And of course, now, as you know, he's become a powerhouse as chairman of the Financial Services Committee of the House, co-author with Chris Dodd of this bill, which has been just at least passed by the Senate and needs reconciliation, but it's basically going to reform Wall Street and how the financial industry operates. Barney is an interesting guy. I'll never forget. My habit was to, well, I don't have him here, but to carry large manila envelopes around. And one day I'll find the one that he gave me. But large manila envelopes around, big enough that you could slip the New York Times and the papers into and hold your correspondence to be signed and things like that, papers that you wanted to look at. And once we had like what amounts to sort of like a ceremony in the judiciary room, Barney had one of his staff take one of those envelopes. They were generic envelopes. Every member had them. And with one of those yellow marking pens, marked some filigree and curlicue stuff around the perimeter of this envelope and have all kinds of doodads in it and ivy and twining and things and make it really an elegant looking thing. Then Barney presented that to me because he said those ragtag envelopes you've been carrying, they start getting soiled after a while and then eventually you do throw them away. But this is what you should be carrying. So he presented that to me. But Barney is a very interesting fellow. And he made that transition, but I don't know that Tom Foley would have made it. So I see Tom. I may see him next month in June because all the former members get together once a year to just see one another. And Tom typically comes, though he's had health problems. He also became ambassador to Japan after he lost. So he had a way that it was put on by the presidents as different of these councils and boards. So he's had a productive post-Congress experience. Some of the other national figures quickly, of course, Al Gore became vice president and just only barely lost becoming president in that Baker versus Gore fight or whatever they call that contest between Bush and Gore, decided by those dangling chads or whatever they call them. Well, Al Gore was in the House, as was Dan Quayle, who was George Herbert Walker Bush's vice president. Dick Cheney was there too, who became George W. Bush's vice president. Cheney, of course, worked in the White House after he left the House of Representatives. Walter Mondale was in the Senate, and he became vice president. Bush himself was in the House, George Herbert Walker. And then Spiro Agnew, whom I never met, but he was the governor of Maryland when I got there to Congress and then became the vice president with Richard Nixon. Spiro Agnew eventually had to leave the office of vice president. I think that's when Nelson Rockefeller came in to be with Nixon, because I think Agnew had to resign for his own problems, so you really had both President Nixon eventually retiring and Spiro Agnew retiring.
He was convicted, wasn't he, of accepting bribes as a governor for construction jobs or something for Maryland?
It was something that goes back to his days as governor of Maryland. And then Joe Biden, who's now the vice president, was in the Senate, and we worked together quite a bit over the years. And Joe Biden, they've toned him down quite a bit now. He's managed to control what I think the term is called logorrhea, which is an excess of words. It's just that words come tumbling out, and words keep tumbling out, and they never stop tumbling out. Joe Biden was nothing if not loquacious, and he has bridled that quite a bit now. I think that they've told Joe that he can't. Every now and then he gets his foot in his mouth, but I guess that's the appealing part of Joe Biden. He's an engaging Irish guy that you can't help but love just because he's who he is. Very well tailored, as you can tell. He's always very well dressed, and the cufflinks and all the things that go with it now, but pleasant fellow. One of the people that I revered but didn't have a chance to really work with because he was killed was Robert Kennedy. I did have a chance to work with Ted Kennedy, one of the memorable senators who just recently passed away, and I served with Joe Kennedy, and I served with Joe, who was Robert's son, as well as the Kennedy from Rhode Island, who's first, Patrick Kennedy, who's Ted's son. So Joe was Robert's son, and Patrick is Ted's son. But Ted Kennedy was an Olympian when it comes to the legislative process. There'll be few people in the history of this America that will rival the description of the work that Ted Kennedy did in immigration, for that matter. He was very active in our immigration bill. He actually was chairman of the committee prior to Al Simpson, and it was the Ronald Reagan's election that put the Democrats in the minority in the Senate, and it elevated Al to chair that committee, vice Ted. And it actually was probably just as well in a way, because Senator Kennedy was pretty well tied into the views on immigration because of the state of Massachusetts and because of his supporters that would not have given him a lot of leeway as to, you know, where to go with that bill and what to be done. Ones that I've met but never worked with, because they were just people that I met, amazing, Pope John Paul II. And we were at a conference in Rome, and the then ambassador to the Vatican, John Gilligan, the former governor of Ohio, whose daughter is Sebelius, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, I think is John Gilligan's daughter. She's also related to the Sebelius family. Keith Sebelius was in Congress when I first got there from Kansas. And we were in Rome, and so Jack Gilligan arranged an audience with John Paul II, and we have pictures of that, which I'll show you someday. Very, very amazing experience, to say the least. Even if you're not Catholic, to meet that man, that position is pretty remarkable. And he was, as has always been characterized, very much a strong man, strong handshake, very virile, and very much given to sports that were like skiing, you know, very arduous type sports. We met when we made the one trip we made to the Middle East back in 1975, met President Anwar Sadat of Egypt and Shimon Peres of Israel. And just today you saw an article in the Wall Street Journal, just today, which is May the 24th of 2010, saw an article in there about Shimon Peres, and about he's still active and trying to figure out whether there's going to be a two-state solution to the Palestinian problem, and who gives first, and where does Iran fit into it. And the premise of the article today was, he said that if enough nations of the world, and particularly the United States, can curb Iran's seeming enthusiasm to do nuclear, to make nuclear power into a weapon of war rather than a peaceful production of electricity, that if we can get Iran to organize itself, then probably the Middle East could be easier settled between Palestine and Israel. So it's kind of interesting. I'm not sure I follow the line of thought, but that was just today. So he remains, and that was in 75, and today is 2010. The figures just keep, he just keeps staying in turn. We met the Dalai Lama once down at the monastery in Gethsemane, just in south of Louisville. Of course, he remains a world figure for peace, and continues to be celebrated in many quarters, including, of course, Tibet, where he's from, but also scorned and objected to by people like the Chinese, who feel like Tibet belongs to China, not as a separate country. And once I was walking down with the young man I was just across the street with just a moment ago, across the river. Thank you. Across the street, just across the river, Peter Buttigieg. We were walking from Harvard Square with a good friend of his, Ryan Ripple, walking across Harvard Square down, I think, Spark Street. Helen was with us, and Ryan Ripple's mother, Barbara, who's unfortunately since passed away, but the that would be what, five of us were walking down, I think, Spark Street or one of those streets that angle out of Harvard Square. We were going for the Porter to Porter Square to take the train up to Concord and see some of the sites of American history, the American Revolution. And we were walking along, and I'm sure that Archbishop Tutu did not want to be recognized. I mean, you could almost tell, but I just couldn't help myself. It was probably very abrupt and ill-mannered of me to do it, but I motioned to the kids, you know, these young people, Peter and Ryan. I said, look, anyway, it turns out to be Bishop Tutu. So I said, Bishop Tutu, you know, no. And so he was very nice, and we didn't tarry, and he didn't, you know, we didn't keep him, detain him, but he was a pretty important, he remains an important figure. He's always talked about that Truth and Reconciliation commissions that he put together, along with the president of that country, the one who was in jail for so very long. And these are pretty important people he's left to.
Okay. Well, Congressman, we've covered the significant amounts of folks today, and probably finishing off with the international figures. The schedule calls for us to get together again tomorrow and to consider the final thoughts on various folks that you knew and worked with. For today, are there any other additions or thoughts that you want to add for today's date?
I'm not so sure additions, but corrections in way or amplifications, because just a moment ago I faltered when I was talking about Hale Boggs, about Hale Boggs' daughter, and it turns out that Hale Boggs' daughter is the lady who's on television that does so very much work. And her name is Cokie Roberts. And thank you again for a little bit of the hint. My memory right this moment was a little faulty. But Cokie Roberts is the daughter of Hale Boggs, who came to speak with me, and then also was the one who died in his effort to support Nick Begich, my congressional colleague. And then the other is, as we were walking down Harvard Square, we talked about meeting Archbishop Tutu, who was such a hero in the South African situation. And I mentioned the other one. He wasn't with Bishop Tutu at that time, but his colleague is Nelson Mandela, who spent many years, 20 years maybe, in jail, who, to his everlasting credit and to Archbishop Tutu's everlasting credit, did not become vindictive or bitter. Did not seek retribution, but all he did was to try to solve the problem and trying to get the people of South Africa to live with one another, the black and the white, the Boer and the natives. And it was pretty amazing stuff. I mean, when you think about it, it's so easy to take offense and never, ever forgive people. And these men, to their everlasting credit, not only forgave the people who oppressed them, but work with some of those self-same people to try to solve the problems of their nation. And so, but those are the two, Cokie, and who's always on television, is really a delightful woman. And maybe at a later time I'll talk about her mom, because Lindy Boggs, who succeeded Hale in Congress, and then, as you probably know, became eventually ambassador to Vatican, the same as Jack Gilligan was. And I have one memorable instance of where she entertained us in Rome and showed her medal as a woman, as an ambassador, as a former member of Congress. Interesting lady. But it's been wonderful, Kevin.
Thank you very much, Congressman, and we'll see you at the next tape.
Have a great day. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Later today, I hope.
Certainly enjoyed this session. Thank you, Congressman.
Thank you very much.